At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Unexplainable is a science show about everything we don't know. Like, we don't know how bikes work.
Get out. Come on.
We don't know where the moon came from.
Holy cow.
You've touched the moon.
This is incredible.
We don't even know what life is.
No one has been able to define life, and some people will tell you it's not possible to.
Unexplainable takes you right up to the edge of what we know and keeps going. New episodes every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Doss here, the lead editor on the A16Z growth team, with a quick bit of context. The conversation that follows is part of a series we recorded last month at our AI Revolution event. This series features some of the most impactful builders in the field of AI, from those who are scaling up big foundation models to those developing products that could transform entire industries. In the conversations, they discuss and debate where we are, where we're going, and the big open questions in AI. For the full series, subscribe to A16Z Live or visit a16z.com/AI Revolution. Before we jump into the conversation, please note that the content here is for informational purposes only, should not be taken as legal, business, tax, or investment advice, or be used to evaluate any investment or security, and is not directed at any investors or potential investors in any A16Z fund. For more details, please see a16z.com/disclosures. And now, let's get into it.
Daphne is like the OG's OG in AI. You know, she was a pioneer at Stanford in different areas of AI, especially in PGMs. She left Stanford to co-found Coursera with Andrew Ng, and actually is now the founder, CEO of Incitro, a tech bio company using AI to develop drugs in life sciences. So Daphne, you know, given all the things you could be doing, like, why life sciences?
It's one of the really hard and really important problems. And there is very few things that are as challenging, as exciting as intervening in a safe and effective way in human health. And so it's just a thing that absolutely needs to be done if we are going to use AI for good, which I think is one of the things that I think I at least really strive to do. The second part of the answer is why now? And what brought me back to this field back in 2016, post-Coursera, was the realization that we can now finally, for the first time, measure biology at scale, both at the cellular level, sometimes the subcellular level, and at the organism level via ways of quantitating human biology. And that gives us, for the very first time, the ability to deploy machine learning in ways where it is truly meaningful to do that, because the data sets are large enough for really interesting machine learning methods to be deployed. And that's something I spent a lot of time thinking about, to your point, Vijay, because at this point, AI people can do pretty much anything.
Yep.
And I am a big believer in leverage. That is, places where you can have a disproportionately large impact. And because of the fact that I had spent a large part of my Stanford career working in these two spaces simultaneously, core machine learning on the one hand and machine learning in service of biomedical data on the other, I actually have the ability to sort of bridge the chasm between these two very disparate disciplines. And when I was leaving Coursera in 2016, and I looked around me and I saw, even at that time, which of course is tiny compared to where we are today, that machine learning was changing the world, it wasn't having much of an impact in the life sciences. And I believe one of the main reasons for that is that because there are so very few people who actually have the language of both disciplines and are able to bring them together. So I felt like I could have impact in AI across many things, but here I could have disproportionate impact.
Well, you know, you spoke about the why now. Mm-hmm. What's your take on AI for life sciences? What's the why now there? And what's different now than, you know, even what we could do even just, let's say, 5 years ago?
So I think it comes back to this ability to collect, but even more than collect and generate data at scale. So one of the things that we have at InCitro that is truly unique is we have a data factory. We have put together the tools that have been developed by people who are taking pluripotent stem cells, which are cells from you or me or anyone in this audience, and turning them into this pluripotent status, which can make a Daphne neuron in a dish or a Daphne hepatocyte in a dish. It's going to be different than the VJ neuron and the VJ hepatocyte because we have different different genetics, and that's going to manifest in how these cells behave and how these cells look in different measurements. We can engineer those to introduce a disease-causing mutation and ask, what does that disease-causing mutation do to a Daphne neuron versus what does it do to a VJ neuron, and what does this mutation do versus that mutation? And so we're able to kind of do data generation on spec, and that is a truly unique capability, which frankly is not that easy to do even in other areas where AI is being deployed. You don't get to make your own data in many cases, but here we do, and that creates both really important discovery opportunities for life sciences, but also really cool and interesting machine learning problems, because you could start doing active learning, you could start to sort of experimental design, and it's actually like a really exciting technical discipline at this point.
Well, maybe you could dive a little deeper and give an example. So like your paper on the PASH approach, I think that came out on Archive. Could you double click on that? Tell people what you did there, especially like why is AI in life sciences a big deal? What could you hope to get?
So first of all, let me tell you a little bit about that platform, which is called POSH, or Pooled Optical Screening in Humans. You take a bunch of cells. They can be cancer cells, but in our cases, they're mostly those induced pluripotent cells with, you know, neurons or whatever. And you put them with a pool of CRISPR guides that edit them. And each cell gets a different guide. So now you have a bunch of cells, each with a genetically diverse mutation. And now they're all sitting there in a pool. You can measure them with a microscope. You can measure them as they move around and do their thing. You can basically fix them, and you sequence the barcode that came with the guide. So now you can say, oh, this cell that got this guide behaved this way, and this other cell behaved that way. And I can tell you that one of the really challenging things about cells is because they're live, if you put different cells in different wells, then they each have a slightly different environment and you get subtle differences and it's really hard to reconcile. When they're all in a pool, you eliminate all of those artifacts and all of a sudden you have the ability to measure a genome-wide CRISPR screen, basically. So 20,000 genes in the genome, all modifying the same cellular background in the same dish with a different genetic intervention. And you're measuring that in a genome-wide scale in like 10 or 12 plates in 2 weeks. Now imagine doing that rinse repeat and doing genome-wide scale on this genetic background or in this cell type. And so you can really start to decipher the genotype-phenotype connection and the effect in which individual genetics makes a difference on cellular phenotypes, which we then translate to what we believe they will have in terms of clinical impact. And that is the beginning of an understanding of what it is that we want to modify in order to have meaningful therapeutic interventions.
Well, yeah, but no, the biology part is really critical because now you get the data, and we all know how important that is. But I think one of the things that's really I found intriguing is the creation of a latent space for human biology. And especially being able to tell the difference between disease and non-disease, or even different disease phenotype. What is that? How does that come about? And like, especially, you know, how is AI driving it?
So actually, I'm going to go back one step further, because you said, of course, one of the things we need to do is get the data. And I should have mentioned that it's impossible to run this instrument without AI being built into it, because you can't even segment the cells. You can't call the barcodes. I mean, all of it is an AI-enabled architecture. Every part of our technology stack is intrinsically AI-enabled. But then, to your point, Vijay, now you have a whole bunch of cellular images, and what do you do with them? And so the first thing we do is we built this latent space. We built a language model for biology. So all of us are like, now everyone's an expert in language models. You just have to explain this to people. It's like, oh, language of biology. No one knew what I was talking about. But now it's like, I'm just saying, look, it's just like GPT, but for cells. And people think they understand. So,
Well, maybe we can double click on that today.
Sure.
Yeah.
So we have the language of, you know, cells and what cells look like, or the transcriptional or gene expression profiles of cells. And you measure hundreds of millions of cells in different states. And now with a much more limited amount of data, because we have this latent space, then just like the large language models for natural language, with a small amount of data, you can start asking, okay, how does disease move you? like a disease-causing gene from one place to the other? How does a treatment move you hopefully back in the opposite direction from the disease state back to the healthy state? And that's super powerful, and it's the gift that keeps on giving. Kind of like other language models, you have this, it keeps getting better the more data you feed it, and over time you end up with a better and better competitive moat, if you will, of how does understanding the core foundations of biology help you understand disease and health better. And let me just say, this is not just for cellular data. The other source of data that we use is clinical data. So we do the same thing with histopathology. There is so much more in histopathology than your pathologist typically looks at. In MRI data, your radiologist doesn't see more than like a small percentage of what's there in your radiology images, but also not just imaging. There's also other modalities where there's an equal amount of information left on the table. And over time, we're learning these languages of different biological modalities and the ability to translate between them.
I think this concept of foundation model for biology is particularly exciting because, 10 years ago, you could have ML that was predictive. You just needed maybe 100 actives.
Yeah.
And the problem is, like, if you have 100 cases, examples of a drug that works, you don't need to design a drug. And so these low-shot, zero-shot approaches right. that come from a foundation model are really night and day. So how far does this go? I mean, the big problem in biology is that biology is hard.
Biology is really hard.
Biology is very hard. And,
sometimes I ask myself, like, really, why am I doing this? I could go write an app for, like, a chat agent.
You could do a fart app or something like that. Yeah.
It would be so much easier, wouldn't it?
It would be a lot easier. But like, so why are you doing it? What is the big win? How does this, like, where does this go, let's say, by the end of the decade? Like, what could you hope to do that we couldn't do before?
We want to do it in a different way. We want to come up with a very, almost like, systematic recipe for how do you go from a decision that I want to work on ALS or I want to work on fatty liver disease through a sequence of steps towards something that results in a meaningful intervention in the right patient population. The hope is that by the end of this decade, we will have built this process, we will have run through it a number of times, we will have delivered some medicines to patients in our first tranche of indications, but then we will have learned enough from that so that we can now say, okay, and here's how we're going to do it here, and here, and here. And because it's not only machine learning that moves forward over time, it's also the biological tools that we're relying on. I mean, it used to be that there wasn't any CRISPR. There was just siRNA. Actually, there wasn't even that. And then there's like CRISPR base editing, and now there's CRISPR prime that replaces entire regions of the genome. So the tools that we're building on also get better and better over time, which unlocks more and more diseases that we could tackle in meaningful ways.
Well, let's step back for a second, because I think this may not be clear for everyone, like why biology is so hard. And one of the biggest reasons is that, if we can do tons of experiments on mice, I have to feel like it's a great time to be a rich mouse. You could be cured of any disease, right? Like all these diseases can be cured in mice. But, it's obviously unethical to experiment on people. And that's why that's one of the big reasons why trials fail, right? Because when you go into a clinical trial, you spent all this money to get there. You're spending all this money, hundreds of millions of dollars in the trial. And it turns out mice are different than people and it fails.
Yeah.
So like, how can AI help that?
So first of all, and this notion of, we can cure lots of mice is something that really drove our discovery strategy at InCitro, which is all of our work is done in human and human-derived systems. So that incorporates at least some subset of human cells working together. So that's one piece. And the nice thing about it is that it allows you to intervene in those systems and ask the what-if questions, the counterfactuals. Like, what if I had this person's biology, but in a world where this gene was inactive versus active, or the other way around. So that's great, but obviously you want to cure people, not cells or even organoids. And so the other source of data that we bring in is data from people, from clinical records. Mm-hmm. And what we end up doing is kind of bridging between the two using machine learning. So using machine learning on the cellular data, using machine learning on the human data, bridging between those in representation space, but also in genetic space, because genetics is kind of like this thread that ties the two together. And without machine learning, without AI, the space would be so complex and so high dimensional that you couldn't even make sense of it, far less bridge between those two different worlds.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. curious to change gears a bit and talk a bit about company building.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting things that you've done is that you've brought together people that are biology experts with people that are ML, AI experts.
Right.
And how do you build that culture? What does that look like, especially since they're from fairly different, you know, parts of the universe?
How do you build that is really hard because you take your average, you know, machine learning scientist and your average life scientist, even if they're very well-intentioned, you put them into the room together, they might as well be talking Thai and Swahili to each other. The languages are different. The ways in which you think are totally different. So how do you create a shared language, a shared vision? And so there's a few tricks or approaches that we use. First of all, we hire some number of people, you can't get enough of them, unfortunately, who are in the middle, who are able to be translators and talk to both sides and kind of bring them together. And then I think the other really important part is that you create a culture of, and you hire very rigorously to that culture of people who are genuinely interested in engaging with the, you know, the other side. And we have a list of company values, and the final value, which is one that I hold particularly dear, it's last, not because it's least important, it's because they're ordered from what we do to how we do it, which is that we engage with each other openly, constructively, and with respect. And each of those words matters. Engage means that we're not siloed. All of our work is done in like cross-functional project teams. Openly means an openness to asking really naive questions when you don't understand, and to accepting really naive suggestions from somebody else, because sometimes the best ideas come from an orthogonal mindset.
It's something that I experienced even as a kid. So my parents are scientists, and my mom warned me, no matter what I do, even though this is what I was doing as a kid, because I was programming as a kid, I should not get into programming or computer science. No one's ever going to make money by selling software. I think maybe then, you know, especially for this audience here that are coming from the AI side, especially as AI gets into areas that are sort of not just the world of bits, but in the world of atoms.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any advice for how to bridge those gaps?
I mean, first of all, having a deep respect for atoms is really important.
Yeah, I mean, some of my closest friends are atoms. Yes.
I think we're all atoms, but I think having an appreciation for the complexity of atoms and the fact that especially when your atoms are part of live systems, they behave in unexpected, unpredictable, idiosyncratic ways that sometimes cause a lot of pain. And I can tell you that when you do biological experiments, one of the strongest signals when you apply machine learning to it is, what was the technician who actually did the experiments? You could read that very clearly off the cells, because they behave a little bit differently. They pipette a little bit differently. They treat the cells a little bit differently. It's amazing how hard that is to clean that up, which is one of the reasons why we spend so much of our time building robots, because they do the same thing over and over again. So I think having a lot of respect for atoms, but also I would say an appreciation for the fact that the next frontier of of the impact that AI can have is when AI starts to touch the physical world. And we've all seen just how much harder that is. We've all seen how hard it is, astonishingly, to build a self-driving car compared to building a chatbot, right? I mean, we've made so much progress on building chatbot, and self-driving cars are still blocking fire trucks in San Francisco. Having an appreciation for that complexity, but also an appreciation for the magnitude of the impact if you can actually nail it.
Where does this all go? Like, you know, you're talking about life sciences in terms of healthcare and drug design, but there's a lot more to biology than just drugs, right? But where do you think this confluence between AI and life sciences goes from here?
So I actually think that there is this incredible opportunity at this point, at this intersection between the two fields. And I will think about it from a little bit of a historical perspective of think back on the history of science. And at certain times in our history, there have been eras where a particular scientific discipline has made incredible amounts of progress in a relatively short amount of time, because there was kind of like a click where we started to see the world in a different way, or there was a tool that wasn't available before. So if you think back to, you know, the late 1800s, that was chemistry, where we suddenly realized, you know, we couldn't really turn lead into gold. And there was this thing called the periodic table, and there were electrons, and it really shifted chemistry. And then in the early 1900s, obviously that discipline was physics, and the connection between energy and matter and between space and time completely shifted our understanding of the universe. In the 1950s, that discipline was computing, where we get these machines that perform calculations that up until that point, only a human was able to perform. And then in the 1990s, there was this interesting bifurcation. On the one side, there was data science that ultimately, you know, that grew on computers, but also had elements of neuroscience and optimization and statistics, and ultimately gave us modern day machine learning and AI. And then the other side was what I think of as quantitative biology, which was the first time where we actually started to measure biology in a scale that was more than like track 3 genes across an experiment that took 5 years. And that was the first microarray data and the first human genome and so on and so forth. And I think this time that we're living is the time when those last two disciplines are actually going to merge. And they're giving us an era of what I think of as digital biology, which is the ability to measure biology at unprecedented fidelity and scale, interprets the unbelievable masses of data, different biological scales and different systems, using the tools of machine learning and data science, and then bring that back to engineer biology using tools like CRISPR, genome editing, and so on, so that we can make biology do things that it would otherwise not want to do.
Well, like what?
So I think there's obviously, as we said, applications in human health, but I think there's applications in agriculture. I don't think we need to tell anybody anymore, although there's still some people who might need to hear it, about the impact of global warming, climate change on our world, and the fact that we need to have crops that are much more resistant to drought and severe weather.
And to feed 10 billion people.
I think there's opportunities in the environment to maybe do better carbon sequestration using maybe plants or algae or who knows what. I actually wish I knew more about that, because that is my alternate life would have been to do that.
Yeah. Well, there's still time, right?
Well, there's still time.
Yes.
So are you funding me for that, BJ?
You come up with the deck, we'll talk.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So there's that. I think there's, you know, biomaterials and so on. There's so many opportunities at this intersection that I would encourage any of you in this audience who are looking for something truly aspirational and exciting to do. I think this convergence is a moment in time for us to make a really big difference in the world that we live in using tools that exist today that did not exist even 5 years ago.
Yeah, with that, I think that's the opportunity at hand. Maybe we'll wrap up there. Let's thank Daphne one more time.
Thanks for listening to this conversation from our AI Revolution series. For more, subscribe to A16Z Live or visit a16z.com/AI Revolution.